It's a magazine you don't have to feel obligated to buy from your nephew's fundraiser. This is Sportsnet Magazine Live, free on your radio. Now. Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
Go ahead.
Saturday morning, everybody. It's Sportsnet Magazine Live for Ben Ennis this Saturday morning. I'm Roger Lajoie. Great to be with you. Ben Nicholson-Smith, Gare Joyce in the house with me. And we got lots to talk about here on the final weekend of the Pan Am Games. We'll talk about that a bit later. Canadian Open is underway as well. All kinds of other chat. The Blue Jays lose to King Felix. But off the top, boys, we were talking throughout the week, hey, what are we going to start the show with? And on Thursday, they dropped the big nuclear bomb. Lou Lamoriello is the general manager of the Toronto Maple Leafs. Gare, nobody saw that one coming. What do you think?
Well, my standard joke, the line that I've used all along is when Brendan came in and took over, the first point of redecorating his office, he took down the curtains and put up tinfoil. It's incredible the degree to which he's managed to keep things tamped down as far as leaks go. I spoke to a couple of people in the organization this week, and they said they were blindsided, that they just had no idea. If it went as far as Mark Hunter and Dubas, like, that would be about the extent of it, because there were people in that organization that just had no clue whatsoever.
You know, I like that. And, Ben, you know this from the dealings with the Blue Jays. Alex Anthopoulos has that ninja kind of thing. Is nobody knows what Alex is doing, and all of a sudden he makes a Reyes trade or brings in Dickey. You know, he's caught everybody out of the blue. I don't know what, and maybe it shouldn't matter, but I got respect for an organization that manages to keep stuff in-house like that. People aren't talking. That shows loyalty to me. I like that.
I agree. I think it definitely does show a good sign that they're able to keep things internal and make decisions without letting it leak out. I think, too, that's increasingly hard to do. Because you know how many people in this city, in this country, would want to be knowing exactly what's happening, and the fact that Lamoriello here, obviously big news for the Leafs.
What was strange, I thought, like coming out of that news conference, and I don't know if you noticed or other people noticed, when they were talking about the process, Shanahan talked about interviewing George McPhee and talking to Mike Fiuta, and you know what? You don't talk about people who finish second and third, you know, in a search for a GM. I thought that was really weird, given that we're able to keep everything, you know, on the down low. Why you, and of course you're going to announce that you're hiring Lou Lamoriello, but why are you also announcing, you know, the guys that finish on the podium?
That was weird. That was weird for sure.
Throwing them under the bus.
Well, it's kind of embarrassing.
Yeah.
More than anything else.
Oh, it's
like,
terrible.
You know, does anybody like to be known as like, yeah, I was applying for the job and I didn't get it or whatever. But that is intriguing. He's 72 years old, though, Gare. And listen, you know him. You did a great story on him years ago. You've been around the game for a lot of years. But you look at the guy, you wonder, at 72, does Lou Lamoriello want the same thing he did when he was 52 or 22? Or, I mean, you know, can he change? Is he going to be, you know, we see him, most of us think he's going to be a mentor here, but is he even capable of doing that? Because you made up a great point. Who have been, his assistant general manager has been over the years in New Jersey?
Yeah, it's not like the Devils have been a pipeline of emerging young hockey management talent. Over time, I've sort of grown more sensitive with issues of age. You know, and like Lou is almost a contemporary, or I'm almost Lou's contemporary, I guess. But I was saying to Ben this morning, when the Phillies won their last World Series and Pat Gillick was GM, and at that point, he's sort of stepped down and took an advisor's role with the team. Pat Gillick was 71. And when he stepped aside in Philadelphia, there were all kinds of people hoping that he would land in Toronto at some point. You know, if not as GM, certainly in an advisor's role. You know, I think Pat Gillick and Lou are remarkably similar characters. Both were in university and playing university sports, varsity sports, at 16. Right, both graduated university at 20. Like at some level, they were super high achievers and high intellects. I think, and you know, they're both quirky. Like I have all kinds of respect for Pat, and you know, I've had less to do with Lou over the years, but I did have like some real exposure to him back when they were winning Stanley Cups in the 90s. You know, I don't think that Lou has changed, and not from 52. I think from 22. I think he's still
same guy.
Same guy.
It's interesting because, and listen, I'm relatively getting close to your contemporary age.
You're never going to catch up.
I don't even know how to answer that. But here's the thing. Here's the thing. Is like I don't have. It's not the problem being 72. The guy wants to be the general manager 72, and he still acts. Scotty Bowman coached till he was 70. Don Cherry's 80 plus. That doesn't bother me. It just makes me wonder, though. Shanahan is there. Hunter is there. Dubas is there. Mike Babcock has a strong personality. Ben, can there be too many people in there? That's why I say it's one thing. Pat Gillick still serves as an advisor and a damn good one. Jimmy Devolano, my buddy in Detroit, isn't, but he's an advisor. Ken Holland's a general manager. He calls him if he needs help. Lou Lamoriello is the general manager by name here. Is that too many people?
I think it can be too many people, and I think it's probably too early to know whether it's going to be too many for the Toronto Maple Leafs, but certainly you look at teams like the Phillies. I mean, Gary, you bring up Pat Gillick. Right now, the Phillies are a little bit of a mess. They have Andy McPhail, Ruben Amaro. They have a new manager, Pete Mäkinen. Sandberg's out. I think that in that instance, you have too many voices. With these Leafs, if they can structure things, I think that if you have one person who's ultimately accountable, that can go a long way toward creating a structure that can work. Even if you have a lot of strong voices, a lot of people who have experiences and different opinions. So I think that's going to be the challenge for the Leafs, and it seems like they're on the right track.
Last word, Shanahan, or is it Lamoriello?
Boy, probably arm wrestling over that. I don't know. It's a question of is Lou going to be the general manager or the general micromanager? And, you know, given his history, I don't think that he's much on delegating authority. He's been, forever was the definer of the Devils. They had great coaches, but they were very secondary to Lou. So, it's a weird fit, and I don't know how it's going to work.
That's really interesting. Sportsnet Magazine Live. I'm Roger Lajoie in for Ben Ennis. Gare Joyce, Ben Nicholson-Smith with me. Later, we'll talk about the Blue Jays Pan Am Games, Canadian Open, lots going on. If you want to reach the show anytime and weigh in, you're welcome. At the Raj 590 is my Twitter handle, at the Raj 590. Drop a tweet and we'll get your part in this program as well. We're here until noon chatting about this. So let me see. You know, it's interesting, Gary, I'm interested in your thoughts on this because you know Lou and you know the situation with a guy like this. Here's another thing. For the last 5 years, the Devils have missed the playoffs. Lou Lamoriello was one of the general managers. I don't know if I can't say definitively he was the only one, but he had to not dress a player because his team was over the salary cap. In other words, the new rules of the NHL caught him off guard. All right. I think this is a great fit if he understands that Mark Hunter and Kyle Dubas would never let that happen. They're the young brains. They're the mentoring. And if he can take that and work with them, I think it's terrific. However, if he still wants to do it Lou's way, then maybe there's going to be a problem.
You know, I wrote about this on our website yesterday. You would have thought that if anyone would be able to transition to the salary cap era, it would have been Lou. Like, because his first Stanley Cup winner was easily in the bottom third of the league in salary back in 95. Even in 2003, they were eighth or ninth overall in salary. Like, he ran a super tight ship. I don't know if you remember, but he let Claude Lemieux go you know, traded him in a contract hassle after the first cup there. Like, Lou is an austere character by nature. And I mean, you look at the jackpots that he landed in Jersey, in the last 10 years, you know, whether it's Kovalchuk, whether it's, you know, like you say, being, hitting the ceiling and having to sit a player, you could see GMs doing that. You would never see him doing it. You could see Glenn Sather doing it. There are all kinds of guys, but Lou wasn't ever a spendthrift.
That was counter the way he operated his teams. It was surprising. It really was.
Oh, he bought, you know, when they won the cup, they bought champagne out of the discount bin. You know, like that's who he was. You know, it's a question that hangs out there. You know, is Lou yesterday's man? That was my whole theme yesterday. You know, he has an amazing record, but he has an amazing mixed record. You know, I mean, it's three decades that you're drawing on. Of course, there's going to be highs and lows. You know, his draft record, you know, you could say, listen, the guy's, you know, he's hit how many grand slams over his career? You know, you get Martin Brodeur, you get Scott Niedermeyer, you get Brendan Shanahan. But, you know, it was funny when David Conte was let go by the Devils, their head of scouting, and it really Lou's number two. He was let go earlier this month. They were bragging about, or they released a statement and, you know, citing his great draft record. You know who they listed the draft, the great drafts over the years. They listed them sequentially. You know who was the last player they named? Brian Gionta. Like, it's been that long. You can say, I guess, Zach Parise comes after that. But even that's 12 years
it's
ago.
It's dated.
Like, the it's scary when you look at their drafts, you know?
Ben, you look at a guy like Kyle Dubas, real young guy. Mark Hunter, who is not as young, but is at the NHL level, still relatively experienced. And then you have a 72-year-old Lou Lamoriello, Brendan Shanahan, and Mike Babcock, who's been around mentoring. You wonder, how are they going to mentor these guys? What exactly? Do those two guys just sit and watch these guys for 3 years, or is it a process? That will be interesting to try to see.
It really will, and I would expect it would be a lot of working together, because if you look at the different skills they offer, it seems like they're complementary. And, you know, Gare, like you said, maybe it's going to be tough to get them to work together, and especially if Lamoriello is on the micromanaging side of things. But in a best-case scenario, you could have guys like Dubas and Mark Hunter watching Lamoriello do what he does best, and maybe that's some combination of things. Maybe it's that attention to detail, learning from him, and then a few years from now, it sounds, though, as though there's a very good chance Dubas could be the GM of this team.
Yeah. You don't want a situation that those guys are saying, hey, Lou, you can't dress for enough tonight. We're over the cap. So maybe they'll keep an eye on that when it comes down to. Can that work in your mind, Gare?
Oh, I mean, I guess the first step is they're going to have to knock out a wall in the boardroom to get everyone in there. But can it work? I suppose it can. I think that some people, Lou being foremost among them, will have to say, I can't go about things as I've gone about them before.
That's the key. That's the key in my mind, and that's what I mean at 72, what the strategy is, how you look at it. You cannot operate. If he's going to operate the Lou way, I think this could be trouble. If he sees this, look, I was with the Devils 28 years. I'm still general manager by title here. I get my input into this organization. And I liked one of all the things you hear after the prep. What I really liked is he said, if Kyle Dubas isn't the general manager material by the end of 3 years, I haven't done my job here. To me, that sounds like that's saying I'm mentoring here as much as I'm doing anything.
Well, and I think a key point here is, and we won't be privy to it, a key point is Brendan's going back and forth with Lou, you know, in their discussing his role. I'm sure that Brendan Shanahan laid out, look, this is what we need and this is what we can't afford. I think, and Lou, you know, talk about a leopard changing its spots or a zebra changing its stripes. Lou's a smart guy. Like, if he knows what Brendan is looking for from him, he'll be able to do the job, I think. He'll be different. The degree to which he'll be different or have to be different, that's still hanging out there.
That's Gare Joyce, Ben Nicholson-Smith, also here from Sportsnet Magazine. I'm Roger Lajoie, in for Ben Ennis. You'd like to weigh in on whatever we're talking about, and right now it's Lou Lamorello. Do it on Twitter, at the Raj 590, at the Raj 590. You can follow me, send a tweet. Do you like the hiring of Lou for the Leafs? We'd like your opinion on that, and we'll talk Blue Jays, Pan Am Games, Canadian Open, and much more right up until noon here on Sportsnet Magazine Live. Here's another problem. That's not a problem. It's just interesting. Ben, Gare, here we are talking the Leafs in July, which is no big deal in Toronto. We talk the Leafs in July all the time. And they're doing a great job keeping in the news in July in the middle of the Pan Am Games and everything else going on. It's great. But we're none of this revolves around a player. It has all been Lou, Babcock, the ownership situation. Now, the Kessel deal, that was a blockbuster. Let's call that for what it is. But this team as it is now, never mind Lou, never mind the five-headed monster that's in the front office, is this team going to be even halfway decent, or are they really going to just hit the tank this year coming up when it comes in? Because right now, everybody's talking about Lou and Babcock, but come October, everybody's going to be talking wins and losses.
Exactly, and that's where the focus should be. I mean, now I think there's increased focus on front offices, and we love knowing who the big names are and imagining what's going on behind the scenes. Ultimately, it doesn't matter much if they can't put a winner on the ice, and at this point, it seems as though they're multiple pieces away from getting there.
You talk about all the attention being on management. The players are probably so grateful for that. You know, you just know that, when Lou is named GM, somewhere Joffrey Leupold is applying another layer of tanning butter, right?
I mean, no one's bugging me all summer. This is great.
Yeah. So, on the flip side, it's probably a real benefit for young players. You know, as I talked to Mitch Marner this week, you know, like all this time that we're discussing who's going to be the next GM or how's it going to work out with Lou and, you know, all this turmoil and strife in the management ranks, you know, this is time where Mitch Marner and William Nylander aren't being heralded as the next big thing, you know, like in a way that there's been so much attention on Connor McDavid or say Jack Eichel in Buffalo. These guys have been able to do their development camp to proceed with their training, you know, without any degree of speculation, simply because all the oxygen in the room is swallowed up by people talking about the management of the Leafs.
Yeah, and once we get to the ice, that will change. So let me ask you this, because to me, this is the bigger question of whether or not Lamorello will work, whether Shanahan will work. Babcock's got a $50 million 8-year deal, so they've got security. They can rebuild properly. They can do all that. But we know when the pressure gets going in this city to do something. We saw it last year. Last year was as ugly as I've seen it in terms of the fans. There were tickets available before Leaf games. They don't like to talk about that, but you could go to the box office and buy a Leaf ticket day of the game. I don't know where they're coming from. Maybe it's a season ticket holder. Maybe they're all sold anyway, but the tickets were there. It had reached ugliness. Yet, if they're going to rebuild, it's going to get even worse in the next couple of years. Lou, Shanahan, Babcock, can they stand still for 2-3 years, maybe longer, but at least 2 or 3 years while this team stinks the joint out?
I mean, they might have to, and that might be one of the bigger tests, especially for a guy in Lamorello who has enjoyed a lot of success. It might be tough, you know, to be overseeing a team that has some real struggles on the ice.
It's going to be interesting in that you look at Lamorello's previous experience, which is entirely in Jersey, and the level of attention that the New Jersey Devils get in the New York metropolitan area and hinterland. I mean, they're probably at best number 13 or 14, in the batting order. Like, they're deep in the bench. You have to flip halfway through the New York Post, to the centerfold to find any sort of coverage of the Devils. The attention, the scrutiny is going to be a real significant change for Lou. I think it will be for Babcock, although he's had it with the Olympics and the like.
Yeah.
But just sort of that daily grind, the coach or GM rolls out there, and it's like a feeding session at the piranha tank at Metro Zoo.
Well, right? But one advantage, I suppose, there's five of them to take that heat. I mean, I don't think, Hunter and Dumas are going to be doing a lot of talking, especially with those three guys. But Lamoriello does have to defer to Babcock. Babcock can defer to Shanahan. And these three guys, and you're right about Lou in particular. There's no question. He's never seen anything like this in his life. Babcock's had the taste. And Shanahan, through his career as a player and everything else, and in the year and a half or however long he's been here, has already seen it, Ben. So I guess it'll be interesting to see who's going to do the talking. Like, when announcement is made, like, they're all going to trot out there? Like, who does the talking? I would suspect it would be the general manager, but who knows?
Yeah, it's a good point. And any one of them have the potential to be front page news, really. I mean, we saw Lou Lamoriello on the cover of the Toronto Sun, Babcock, Shanahan, even Dubas. They all have this potential. They're all pretty well-known guys. I think if you were to, list off which are the best-known Canadian sports executives, those guys would all be pretty high on the list.
Lou early on had a reputation for being media unfriendly. And I always thought that was slightly unfair. Lou will talk. He just won't talk about what you want him to talk about, he will talk he will postulate about the state of the game and things like that. If you ask him anything to do with what he's going to do next or what fell through or anything like that, he's a stonewall. I'm sure that he'll be out there at some intervals, probably more than Shanahan was this past season, who he kept a very low profile and was able to say, hey, I'm not a GM, I'm a team president. Lou will have to be out there a bit more. I don't think you would have to surgically remove a meaningful quote from Lou Lamoriello.
Go back 18 months, end of the day, bottom line on this. Shanahan, Lamoriello, and Babcock are running the Toronto Maple Leafs. In my mind, and there's no guarantees, we'll find out, that is a significant upgrade. I like it all. I think it's a lot better. I think the biggest concern I have isn't those three guys' abilities. They're all winners. There's no question about that. A lot of Stanley Cups among those guys and Olympic gold medals. A lot of winners. I'm not worried about that. Can they really stand the heat, though, when it starts? And if this team starts the year 3-11, which might very well be possible, because all they've done in the offseason is get rid of their best goal scorer for prospects and draft picks, which is great, but that's what you're supposed to do. I like it. Bottom line, do you like it, Ben?
Yeah, I do. And I don't think that it means that the Leafs are going to be a good team next year. I'm not expecting that in the least, but I think that they're better prepared for the long term, and that's what you should be asking for from an organization that was really struggling.
Care?
I like it because it's interesting.
I'm
not invested in them winning or losing. I'm just invested in the spectacle of it. It'll be fascinating to watch how it plays out. But when you were saying that, and you said, what happens if they start at 3-11? And my reaction would be 3-11 or worse. It could really go sideways and go sideways early. And you just wonder about the effect that would have on the Morgan Rileys and the young players.
Although, if you're rebuilding, maybe the best thing is to start 3-11. Isn't with the problem been in the past that they start 7-7 and hey, maybe we're a playoff team and hey, we're right on the cusp. Isn't that what stopped this team in the past? That's what I mean by having the the guts to stick it out and do it properly, because they never have. People say, well, what about the 1980s? And Gary, you know as well as I do, they didn't never rebuilt in the 1980s. They just stunk. It wasn't a rebuilding program. They didn't unload it. They didn't stock up picks. They weren't trying to do anything. They were just terrible.
Well, they should get medical researchers in there to look at the effects of, you know, tank seasons and the like on the development of
players.
You know, because I can't imagine it has a positive effect on a player like Morgan Riley. You know, it can't possibly be good to be around something like that in a you know, to cut your teeth as a pro in a poison dressing room. Well, and in an environment just filled with defeat.
I think we can ask the Edmonton Oilers young players how they feel about it. That would be the best answer to that, maybe. Sportsnet Magazine, Gair Joyce, Ben Nicholson-Smith. I'm Roger Lajoie for Ben Ennis. Coming up, the Toronto Blue Jays lose to King Felix. Well, that's no big surprise. They're 49-49. Maybe that's not such a big surprise, but they have still not addressed the pitching woes that we were talking about at the end of last season. Should that be considered a surprise? That's next on Sportsnet Magazine Live on Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
As an unlicensed doctor, we suggest a prescription for one of our shows. Sign up for our free podcast at iTunes or with your favorite podcatcher. Fake doctor's orders. Sportsnet 590, The Fan on demand.
Sportsnet Magazine Live, I'm Roger Lajoie, in for Ben Ennis, Gair Joyce, Ben Nicholson-Smith with me this morning. Later on, we'll talk about the Pan Am Games that wrap up this weekend. Were they a success athletically? Without question. Were they needed and a good idea for the city? That's quite another. We'll talk about the RBC Canadian Open. That's underway as well. And some controversy for sure. And Jose Bautista weighing in, and rightfully so, on the ridiculous comments of Colin Cowherd. We'll talk about that in our 11 o'clock hour. Anything we're talking about, we welcome your feedback at the Rog 590, at the Rog 590. And you can email Roger at sportsnet590.ca anytime as well. Boys, the Blue Jays on their West Coast trip. Lots of speculation around. Let's start with this fact, Ben. Does it really matter at 49-49, 5.5 games back now, 4 or 5 back of a wild card, whatever it is, that they win a couple of games in Seattle, or even next week, when it stretches into next week, win a couple of games, i.e., if by July 28th, 29th, they're 8 games back, 3 games under 500, does that change the philosophy, or are they already committed, they're going to make a deal here?
I think they're going to make a deal, and I think that certainly if they go on a long losing streak, then that could always change things, but I really think that their need is pretty clear, and you can always look at adding guys who are controllable beyond this season. It's a great time to make moves. The Blue Jays could talk with a team like the Padres about, say, Andrew Kashner, the Indians about Carlos Carrasco. So there are always ways that you can bolster your pitching staff, not only for this year, but for future seasons. One way or another, I think their need couldn't be much more apparent with Felix DuBront slated to start Tuesday, and I do think they're going to make a move.
Well, I know that there are people on this network who hate the term must win. I think that these two games against Seattle this weekend are can't lose games. If they're 49-51 Monday morning, I don't think they're making any sort of deal.
I think they're
4 out now, but it's bunched, and you know, 4 out of the second wild card. The Yankees, they're just not making any ground on them. I don't know. I mean, if they lose 2 this weekend, they could be 6 out and with teams to jump.
I still think, though, that if you lose 2 this weekend, you're 49-51 at that point. You're coming back home. You're facing the Phillies, who are the worst team in baseball and getting worse, presuming they trade Cole Hamels or Jonathan Papelbon. And you still have that very apparent need. The team you're chasing is the Minnesota Twins. They're not, you know, the 27 Yankees, they're not even the Dodgers or the Pirates that we see in the National League right now. They're a catchable team. And I think the Blue Jays would still be aggressive even if they lose those games.
But that's been the case all year. It's been there for the taking since day one this season. This is no surprise to us at all. In fact, be honest with you, I'm kind of surprised the Astros are 12 games over 500. I'm kind of surprised the Twins are even 8 games over 500. I'm even surprised the Yankees are 9 or 10 games. What did we have, Gare, for like a decade? The Yankees, 98 wins. The Red Sox, 97. The Yankees, 101. The Red Sox, 99. We can't. J.P. Ricciardi moaned about it for a decade of how tough it is. Now it's right there for the giving. If they're 51-49 or 49-51, get a pitcher either way, I say.
Yeah, well, you know, to Ben's point, saying that Minnesota is catchable, I mean, the thing is, the Jays aren't the only ones chasing, you know? And if you're using the Twins as a measure, you also have to use the other teams that are chasing as a measure. You know, and I don't know that it inspires a whole heck of a lot of confidence at this point. You know, they caught a good break not having to face Kazmir, you know, in the finale in Oakland. It would have been nicer if he'd been out there pitching for the Jays, which would have been like one of the sweetest things ever. But
could have just walked over from the other clubhouse. Those are the best deals. I love those when they're made. Just walk over the other clubhouse, change your jersey, get pitching, buddy.
Yeah.
He knows the opposition. That's for fun.
That's exactly right. Oh, what an advantage that would have been, for heaven's sakes. All right. Here's another way to look at it then, when we talk about it, because ultimately, whether you think a team should make a deal depends on how good you think they are right now and how close they are. And we talked about this on Sportsnet 590 The Fan, a couple of shows I did throughout the week, guys. And one of the callers brought up a good point. It was a great point, actually. It was last year, Oakland, Detroit trying to do it. Now, it didn't work out for them. There's no guarantees, all right? We all know that. There's no guarantees. But his point was, when they made the deal, and Jerry Howarth also echoed this when he's on, when they made the deal, they had the best record in baseball. You have the best record in baseball, you're incumbent to make a deal. You're incumbent to do something. You got to go for it. To Gare's point about the importance of what their record is, you're 2 games under 500, and you're chasing 4 teams for a wild card, and you have to do something. I still say, though, you do, because it's winnable this year. Like, the Yankees are not that good. I can't figure. You look at, is there anybody that goes to the plate that isn't limping that's a Yankee? Have you seen those guys? I mean, come on. Beltran, Ellsbury. A-Rod's a great story, but please. Sabathia, all right, do nothing. Wait another year. Ben, I think you are the Yankees in the right. And what are they going to do in the offseason?
Absolutely. They're going to look to improve, as they always do. The Blue Jays still have 13 games against the Yankees. That's a lot of time to potentially make up ground. I think, you know, to the question of what kind of team the Blue Jays are, I don't think they're a phenomenal team, but I think they're a better team than they've shown. They certainly have a great offense. They have a very vulnerable fifth starter spot right now. You go out and upgrade that, you give yourself a shot. And I agree that there are a lot of teams in there, but none of those teams, the Orioles, the Rays, none of those teams are all that scary, and they all have flaws of their own. So I do think it's worth taking a shot at this, and I think that to do that, you got to go out and add that arm.
You look at the price point on Kazmir, and like, if that's the going rate, then they have to take a shot. But again, it's the existential question, you know. Like, they'll be in a middle ground. Like, if they're 3 or 4 games under 500 next week, you know, coming up to the deadline, are you really a serious buyer, or, you know, are you an impulse shopper?
Maybe you're an impulse shopper, but I think there will be enough guys out there, whether it's, say, Dan Heron. I don't think that the market for him is going to be crazy. You can get him, bolster your staff, and not have to give up big-time pieces. If the Blue Jays do have a really rough week, I don't think you're talking about giving up Daniel Norris and Dalton Pompey the way maybe you would otherwise consider trading those guys. But as things stand now, 500 ball club, they're in a good position. I think that you do look at those top-of-the-rotation arms, and you take a hard look at Samardzija and Cueto, and see if you can't bring them here.
Who's out there that's controllable?
You could look at Cashner and Tyson Ross with the Padres. Carlos Carrasco, they reportedly made a run at from Cleveland. He would have been a great pickup. There's so many guys. I mean, even if you look at a guy, you know, David Price, Johnny Cueto, those are the rentals. But I think that you can get creative and look to those guys you can keep for 2016.
Well, all right, and keep them for 2016 is one thing. And then you look at, you know, you guys referred to the number 5 starter. They don't have a number 5 starter. They just use whoever's available. Matt Boyd, Felix Dubron, whoever they can call up from Buffalo. That's ridiculous. If you're really trying to be, if you're not going to be in the playoffs this year and you understand that, that's acceptable. Sure, call up a guy from Buffalo as your spot starter. you're trying to move in. You are where you are in that division in a crappy year. And the best you got is Boyd, who clearly is not ready, and Felix DuBront. And I get it. He's been okay. But come on. Okay, you got to be better than okay in a year like this.
Absolutely.
I'm preparing myself for the narrative that we're going to hear next week, is that our biggest acquisition on the deadline is Sanchez, right? Like,
we got a player back.
Yeah. Uh-huh. You know, like, yeah.
I don't think that would disappoint a lot of people, and rightfully so.
The other thing you hear is that, we wanted to make a deal, but they wanted Stroman and Sanchez and Bautista and Edwin and $80 million as well. Like, the deal was impossible because, and how can you verify that?
Right.
How can you ask somebody if that's the case?
And of course, teams are asking about those top pitchers. I mean, why wouldn't they? And that's where the ask starts. But I think in the next 6-7 days, we're going to see that asking price drop down a little bit. You know, the Astros gave up a very good prospect in Nottingham, but he's not a world beater. He's not a top 10 guy. I think that there's going to be enough of a middle ground for the Blue Jays with these teams selling arms, where they're able to make a deal and get something done to bolster this staff.
Is Castro one of the guys that's in play?
I would think so. If I'm another team, I'd look at Miguel Castro and think that, hey, this is a guy who can slot in as a potential impact bullpen arm. That said, he's not an elite prospect.
And, well, that's what fans are a little different than general managers, because fans see them come up in the majors. They don't have instant success, and now nobody talks about Castro. Because, you know, it's one of those things. It's just, Hoffman's a new guy because we haven't seen him come up. And Daniel Norris, we don't talk about him as much because he came up and he struggled a bit. And now these guys, but you can't trade Hoffman. You can't trade Hoffman, but you can trade Norris and Castro because, well, they didn't come into the majors and, throw aspirins in their first couple of starts. And for every prospect out there, there's a Kyle Drabecker or a Ricky Romero or somebody that doesn't. End of the day, do you want to take a chance and do something or do you not? Ultimately, and that, Gare, to your point, is like, you have to take a look at the landscape of this trade deadline period now. And if this team is 49-50, well, let's play the worst case. 49-51, Monday morning, 7.5 back of the Yankees, 6 back of a wild card, 4 teams ahead of them. Do you stop taking phone calls?
Well, Alex Anthopoulos never stops taking phone calls.
Well, no.
So he'll be on that phone regardless.
Yeah.
He works for Rogers, too. He's got to take phone calls, get the cell phone bill up, for heaven's sakes. How about the other teams around them? Tampa Bay, Baltimore. We talked to the Yankees, obviously, are in a contending team. They got a great spot. I don't like them. Brian Cashman's keeping a little cards close to the vest. But the expectation's pretty low in New York that he's really not going to do anything. We'll see. What about Tampa Bay and Baltimore? Are there any reason to think that, they're in the same position as the Jays? You think they do anything?
Tampa Bay will be an opportunistic buyer. They could even listen on some of their relievers and potentially make a move there. Baltimore, I think they're really on the fence. They'd like to add an outfielder, but at the same time, I don't think they're going to mortgage their future when they're at a point in the standings where they don't really have any guarantees. And the Yankees, it's true. I mean, they're doing a very good job of keeping those expectations low, definitely in contrast to certain other American League East teams we could name.
That is the longest of long shots, keeping expectations low
in New York,
the Bronx, right? Like, that is just crazy. And I have a bunch of New York friends and Yankees fans, no less. And, it's not that they fell out of love with this team or anything like that, but, I think even they are sort of, pinch me, how are they getting it done?
Yeah.
But does that mean they're vulnerable? They've been doing it too long at this point to say, no, it's not real.
Do they have one more season in that over-the-hill gang? Can Alex Rodriguez have a 30-homer season, hit another 10? Can Beltran contribute? Is Ellsbury going to stay healthy? Sabat Tanaka's arm is hanging by a thread. If it does, okay. But that doesn't mean they're not catchable. And your point about 13 games left with the Yankees, that's huge.
It is.
So you go 9-4 with the Yankees, you're basically even.
Yeah, and that's a tall order. I mean, the Yankees are a good team. I don't think that they're a great team, but they're a pretty solid team. And I think that you look at their recipe for success with the late inning relievers they have, Miller and Betances. I mean, if you get a lead through 7 innings, it's going to be tough to come back against New York.
Be tough if the Blue Jays had a bullpen, too, to come back if they could get a pitcher. And that's the whole discussion going round and round, isn't it? Sportsnet Magazine Live, I'm Roger Lajoie, in for Ben Ennis. Gare Joyce, Ben Nicholson-Smith in the house with me. Hey, coming up, the Pan Am Games have been great. 195 medals and counting for Canada. The big closing ceremonies, everybody feels good. Are we going to have a hangover on Monday morning when the bill comes in from this party? We'll talk about that next on Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
This ain't like when you're at a game and sign up for a credit card just to get the prize and then you immediately cancel the credit card. Because there's no prize when you sign up for our radio shows at iTunes or with your favorite podcatcher. Sportsnet 590, The Fan on demand. This is Sportsnet Magazine Live, free on your radio. Now. Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
Check out the latest edition of Sportsnet Magazine, available everywhere, on newsstands, on your iPad. Sportsnet.ca has got all the details. It's a terrific read, and it's a terrific listen, too, because we've been listening to Gare Joyce, Ben Nicholson-Smith the last hour. I'm Roger Lajoie in for Ben Ennis, and we're here until noon as we continue to talk about the top sports topics of a busy week in Toronto. Later, the Canadian Open, the RBC Canadian Open is in town. We'll talk about that. NHL expansion talk, that kind of got pushed back a little bit, but Las Vegas and Quebec both making bids. $2 million non-refundable. Of all the stuff about an NHL expansion bid as a poor man, I'm thinking, wait a minute. So even if this conversation goes nowhere, it's going to cost me $2 million. That's why probably I don't have 20 cents, never mind $2 million. We'll talk about that later. But speaking of money, Pan Am Games has been on the field, on the court, everywhere, over the top, terrific. I don't know if you guys agree, but it's been great. Canada's had 195 medals. It's been terrific. The memorable baseball game, what an overtime basketball game last night. The city's been good. I think there's been a lot of partying. I think it's been great. So how are we going to feel about this on Monday morning as opposed to how we feel here on Saturday morning waiting for a few more medals to come Canada's way?
I think that's the big question because we've seen all the benefits of it, right? And like you said, it's been tremendous watching these athletes performing on this big stage and really succeeding, in particular, a ton of Canadians doing great things. So we've seen all of the good side of it at this point, or just about all of it. Some events still ongoing, of course, but those costs, you know, we'll still have to play out in the course of the next couple of days and even weeks and months. And until that happens, it's tough to make a total assessment of how those games have gone.
I would say it's not even weeks and months, but it's a matter of years. You know, like in 2020, a Canadian Olympic basketball team, and Jamal Murray's a star for it. And people will say, geez, like, when was it that he really broke through? And then it all flashed. Yeah, it was, he was in high school, you know, leading a Canadian team over the U.S. at in Toronto at the Pan Ams. And we'll be that way with Andre Lagrassi, the sprinter. You know, it's like, when did he come on the scene? You know, when he's on a podium, whether it's in Rio or down the line. And it's like, oh, yeah, you know, it was his coming out party in Toronto. So, I mean, I think as years move on, you know, there's a lot of people who made an impression at this event. And, you know, it's a defining moment for them, but also a springboard for them.
Well, there's no question, and that's all athletically again, guys. There is no question about that. I think it's indisputable. I think Canada has done a terrific job. You're right about Murray. The baseball story is terrific. And yes, there will be times, and who knows, we can't measure this, how many 8, 9, 10-year-olds are watching this going, I'm going to be a Canadian athlete now. All good. But does the party have to be hosted and paid for here? Can't somebody else do this? It's like people have said, and I took calls on this last week, guys, on Sportsnet 590 The Fan, and caller brought up a great point in saying, you know what, it's terrific. I don't want the party to be here. I don't want the bill from this thing. The Pan Am Games are great. It's absolutely fantastic. I can watch it on TV. In fact, unless you're at the events live, you're watching it on television itself. And that is going to be the question moving forward is it worth it? Right now, it's indisputable. These Canadian athletes, that basketball game last night was fantastic. That was a spectacle. It's great. What did it cost? And we're going to find that out probably Monday.
Yeah, and it's a big cost. We're talking billions of dollars here, and there is kind of a vanity element to it. Anytime that you have these politicians making bids, and some people stand to benefit more than others from it, where everyone is paying the cost. It's a shared cost that's going to be spread over the course of years. Not to take away, of course, from the tremendous athletics that we've seen, like you said, Roger, but I do think there is that give and take.
Yeah, it's funny when you're talking about the price tag that's attached to it, you know, in the principals who are, you know, starring in it, you know, it actually didn't take billions of dollars to make a Jamal Murray or to take, you know, to make a Legrassi. You know, it took coaching and sacrifice and in some ways making do, making more of less, you know. The idea that that the Pan Ams are a necessary thing for advancing Canadian sport, I'm not really so sure about that. I think they're great theater, you know, as a necessity, that they're here. I don't see that.
Well, they're definitely not a necessity. I there's no question you can live without a Pan Am Games. Now, athletically, 72 goals, 63 silver, 60 bronze, 195 medals, highest total in Canadian history by far. The 72 goals by far as well, and still day and a half or so of competition left, so that total will be added to, so it is terrific. The memories that are going to stand out are the marquee events, though. And you know, that's the unfortunate thing, because everyone says, well, the Pan Am Games, the other sports will, you know, take center stage. No, they don't. We're going to remember basketball. We're going to remember Murray. We're going to remember that incredible baseball game with the pickoff play. The other events are great, but ultimately moving forward, these games are going to be defined by Canada beating the U.S. in basketball and baseball, are they not?
I think in a big way they are. And who can forget that image of Pete Orr rounding third base and scoring on that crazy play in the men's baseball final? I mean, the women's baseball team has a chance to create some memorable moments of their own in the next couple of days as they play out in Ajax and try to win another gold. But I think, too, some of those unheralded sports, I mean, I don't know how many people have talked to me about the rugby and how much fun that was watching the Canadian rugby team. So I think that you do see some other sports rise to the top as well.
Yeah, the Canadian women in basketball was another one that we should mention.
Terrific story, well. Gold medal, absolutely.
You know, like, that might actually be a more meaningful win in some ways than Canada beating the U.S. In the men's semi. You know, it's a curious thing. I'm not saying that there is, you know, that there can't be a real sports legacy for hosting an event like this. You know, you look at Calgary in 88, hosting the Olympics. You know, the Calgary Olympics in 88 provided some real, you know, fundamental support for Canadian winter sport, you know, in terms of training facilities and the like. Like, I do think that it was important. But if you go back to 76, and you and I were talking about this, we both went to the games in 76. We weren't competing, but we went.
I was, but
yeah,
anyway,
you were.
Story.
Yeah.
Oh, no, I wasn't.
Yeah. The beanbag race. But I don't think that there was a big legacy that came out of that.
Oh, there was a legacy, a massive tax bill,
yeah,
and an embarrassment of a stadium and a taxpayer bath that was, and that was the Olympics. Yeah. That wasn't a Pan Am Games. That was the Olympics. Now, you're right about Calgary. Calgary was over the top. One of the reasons we're an Olympic power in the Winter Olympics now is because of Calgary and hosting it. I get that.
Yeah.
I get the feel good the kids are watching. I get that. I don't want our athletes eating Kraft dinner. We don't have those stories anymore. And the only thing we have to crow about is our personal best. We're beyond that. Good, good, good. Guys, it comes down again to the price tag of this. And could we have not had this kind of Pan Am Games somewhere else? Did Canada, as we talked about, have to host it and do the bill? Could we have not beaten the United States in Brazil or Colombia or Mexico or Argentina or Guatemala or Chile or whoever else wants to host these things? That's my issue with it. And I guess the legacy is going to be, is this going to lead to an Olympic bid? And what do you think about that, Gary? You saw an Olympics. What do you think?
I hope it doesn't. I really hope it doesn't lead to an Olympic bid. You know, I'm all for public investment in a facility that provides grassroots support in a reasonable way, you know. And if there are one thing, if there's one thing that the Olympics aren't, it's reasonable in terms of scale. You know, I hope it doesn't go that way. You know what? I'm sure that someone will get together and put a bid together, and it'll be like Paul Henderson's bid years back that
doomed to failure.
Yeah, yeah. Oh no, we're it's like Canada at the Olympics. When we're bidding for him, we're just trying to get on the podium. You know, if we finish third, hey, we're world class.
I'd be happy to finish third in a bidding process. Well, actually, I don't want any bidding because it costs a lot of money to even bid. But the worst thing, I think, is to win the bid. It's not the bidding that scares me. It's winning the bid. Ben, you're a younger guy. What do you think? You want an Olympics in town?
Well, no, I wouldn't. And I think that it comes down to what the goal is as a country or as a city. If your goal is to develop amateur athletes and amateur athletics, then I think there are other ways that you can do that more efficiently and at less of a cost to your citizens than by spending huge amounts of money on a bid or on actually hosting a games. I think that you can do it at the grassroots level, and you can make sure that these athletes have the right nutrition, the right coaching, right support, the money they need for uniforms, equipment, all those sorts of things can pay off, and you can develop these Jamal Murrays without having to spend hundreds of millions or billions of dollars on actually hosting a games.
Yeah, you know, like we were in talking about Calgary, Calgary essentially changed the culture of winter sports, you know, at an elite level in Canada. Are the Pan Ams going to do that here?
That's the question. Exactly.
Not a chance.
Exactly.
Would the Olympics do it? It really didn't happen. And they tried in Montreal in 76. And a lot of national sports programs and funding were put into place, you know, in the run-up to that. Did it have a meaningful difference? I don't know. You know, there was great support around Vancouver, you know, in the run-up to that. Would we see it if Toronto gets an Olympics, or if Canada gets another summer games, whether it's Toronto or not?
That's Gare Joyce, Ben Nicholson-Smith from Sportsnet Magazine. I'm Roger Lajoie for Ben Ennis at Sportsnet Magazine Live on Sportsnet 590 The Fan. Glad you're with us. Reach me on Twitter at TheRaj590, at TheRaj590. Weigh in on anything we're talking about. I'll read your tweets in our final segment of the program. We're here until noon. I'm also here until 3 hosting Sportsnet Today. Later, we'll talk about the RBC Canadian Open, Colin Coward's comments, and some NHL expansion talk and more. And again, on Twitter, at TheRaj590. You can email Roger at Sportsnet590.ca, like your feedback. Okay, I don't want to be criticized for just talking about this, the legacy of these games, because that is a topic perhaps better served for next week. So let's talk about some of the stuff we saw last night. You're familiar with Jamal Murray and that Canadian team.
Sure.
That was an incredible performance, fabulous game. What does it mean long-term, not just for him, but for Canada basketball, to beat the Americans like that?
Well, to beat those Americans last night, I'm not really sure. You know, neither side has their elite roster, you know. Certainly, looking at the Canadian roster, I mean, maybe Jamal Murray would be, like, cheering on the sidelines for a real Canadian national team at this point, if you're looking at qualifying for the Olympics and the like. I mean, there are enough NBA players. You know, Andrew Nicholson, who was the leading scorer last night, I think that he would be, you know, he would be in the mix, down in the mix, you know, if you're talking about the best Canadian eight that we could get, best Canadian eight-man rotation. But, you know, that's not to say it didn't mean anything. You know, it was a great moment for Jamal Murray, you know, for a high schooler to succeed at that level. And, you know, I've seen Jamal play a lot the past couple of years. He's, you know, he's going to be a first-round pick. I think there's a really good chance he's going to be a top 20 pick after he plays next season at Kentucky. You know, he accelerated this year. He should actually have another year of high school left. But you know what? He ran out of challenges in the high school game. He had nothing to gain. I was out at the Nike Hoop Summit in Portland a couple months back. And, you know, he is, I think he was the second youngest, not the youngest guy on the court, but it's all high school seniors. And he is, you know, de facto a junior. He was the leading scorer with Ben Simmons and Sky LeBessier, the top two rated in this recruiting class. Jamal tore it up. You know, he was fantastic. That gets Kentucky and Coach Cal knocking on his door. I mean, you know, this is a serious, serious talent. Jamal will be there, you know, in international competition 2 and 3 and 5 years down the line. And, you know, as it's, I don't want to say, you know, that he's Wiggins-like, you know, but he can be a starter on an Olympic medal-winning team if you're projecting to 2020.
Great potential, without question. And Ben, the fact that, you know, he's getting the ball as an 18-year-old chance to win the game. You saw the performance last night. Boy, that was a spectacle.
Yeah, it's impressive. It tells you what kind of talent he has. And it's one of those moments where it's a big stage for a young player to start getting used to the spotlight. And it sounds like, you know, if he's going to Kentucky and a potential first-round pick, that's something he's going to have a lot more experience with in the coming years. But this can be one of those building block moments.
Gare, earlier you said the women winning the gold was even more significant than the men winning the gold over the Americans. Why is that?
I think it was just more representative teams. You know, I think that there were more, you know, national elite players on both sides, you know, closer to what would be out there in major international play for that reason alone.
That's a legitimate victory for sure. Terrific to see. So both gold medals in basketball. The baseball game, Ben, was phenomenal. We talked about it a little bit in terms of the way it ended, the pickoff and everything else, but never mind the way it ended as a spectacle. What does that mean to Canadian baseball that Team Canada Pan Am's game team was able to beat the American Pan Am Games team?
You know, I think it's very similar to the basketball teams in that these are not the best American baseball players.
It felt like the Bad News Bears to me.
Yeah.
There were a lot of mistakes for a national event.
Yeah, for sure, for sure. And I think it wasn't the best Canadian baseball team that you could put together. I mean, Russell Martin's playing for the Toronto Blue Jays. You know, Justin Morneau is dealing with concussions. And you have these really, Joey Votto's playing for the Reds. So these guys are not suiting up. That being said, they had some really talented guys, Jeff Francis, Andrew Albers. They played in the big leagues this year for the Toronto Blue Jays. So you had some legitimate talent. Pete Orr, of course, big time major league experience as well. I think it's great. It's good for the development of the Canadian baseball program. A lot of these, some of the younger players can certainly take that and move forward with it. At the same time, I'm not going to say that Canada has a more talented group of baseball players than the Americans. Of course, that's not true.
I love seeing it for Jeff Francis. Like he is a seriously great guy. Like, you know,
yeah, it's nice.
I don't want to say it's done for Jeff Francis because guys have come back from farther off the radar than
Scott Kazmir.
What's that?
Like Scott Kazmir, who was pitching in independent ball a few years ago.
Yeah, yeah. But you know, if that's Jeff Francis's, you know, curtain call or you know his walking off into the sunset, that's great.
Absolutely.
It was a tremendous performance, and he is a good guy. It's a great story, too.
A ringer for Tom Cavanaugh, the star of Ed. I don't know if you remember that series. Like, it's remarkable how much they look alike.
The similarity, yeah. You're right about that. Andre DeGrasse was a fabulous story as well, of course. Just a terrific gold medal performance, double gold medal performance. First Canadian history to run both the sub-10 in the 100 meters and a sub-20 in the 200. That is a phenomenal achievement in and of itself. And one thing you can say about the track events, regardless of the competition, your time is your time. And he was electrifying to watch.
It's funny. As good as he was here, you know, the word was that this wasn't necessarily a race that he was pointing to at all. And that he's actually in a phase of training where you know, is he at 85 or 90%, something like that? When you look at the time that he ran in the NC2As, wind assisted, but still, 9.75, like it's the eighth fastest wind assisted time of all time. His 200 time in the NC2As was better as well. I mean, if you're talking the Bolts of the world and the like, okay, you know, gold at the Worlds, which are in Beijing in August, you know, maybe gold's not on the table, but, you know, gold in his future in international competition, you can see it. I mean, it's an amazing feat that he basically had, you know, I don't want to say zero high school track background, but he was very late to the game. In grade 11 or 12 when he was at all serious about it. And for him to get as far as he has, as fast as he has, it really is a promising stuff.
Ben, he's got to be considered the individual star for Canada at Pan Am Games, that's for sure.
Yeah, I think he'd have to be up there. And great, great performances for him, of course. It's just amazing when you look at it on that global scale, and the fact that you can put him in that same conversation as someone like a Bolt, that's pretty impressive stuff.
Yeah, 9.75 at age 20, that's crazy. Like that is something. So
burning the track for sure. One of the great stories. And once again, welcome to everybody visiting our great city for the Pan Am Games. Yes, there'll be some questions asked about this big time once it's over, but for the 2 weeks the world was here, or a good portion of the world was here. We enjoyed having you. Enjoy the closing ceremonies.
And listening to us complain.
And complain about it, yes. And Canada, with 195 medals, nobody is complaining about that. Tremendous, tremendous performance as well. Gare Joyce, Ben Nicholson-Smith from Sportsnet Magazine. With me, I'm Roger Lajoie for Ben Ennis on Sportsnet Magazine Live. Coming up, you got an extra $2 million that you could part with just in case. Just see if you're interested in an NHL franchise. Apparently, nobody in Toronto did. But some people in Quebec City and Vegas, no problem. We'll talk about that and more next on Sportsnet Magazine, live on Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
Subscribe to our radio shows at iTunes or with your favorite podcatcher. No medical exam or health questions will be asked. Sportsnet 590, The Fan, on demand. Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
Magazine Live for Ben Ennis. I'm Roger Lajoie this Saturday morning. Great to be with you folks. Gare Joyce, Ben Nicholson-Smith with me from Sportsnet Magazine. Anything we're talking about, we'd like your feedback, and we've had a lot of feedback at The Raj 590, at The Raj 590, yeah, on Twitter. Adult tweets in. This is about the Lou Lamoriello hiring. I like the hiring. Shanahan has a lot on his plate and has brought in an experienced team that fans can trust. Thank you, Adel. Jeremy tweets in, Lou hiring will be a great transition to one of the youngs, which is, I think, the whole point. I would agree with that. Dino does not agree so much. He says it was Jacques Lemaire, not Lamoriello, responsible for the Devils' success. Lemaire was a part of it, but you got to give Lou credit.
One Stanley Cup.
Yeah.
Just one.
Exactly. And Lamoriello was there 28 years in Jersey, yeah, and built the team. Daryl says, love it. Only concern is the egos that are in management team now and how they work together. Daryl, that is a fair point. It's always good to hear from you. Christian says, it's old news, and who will say no? It's not like a cap signing. No, it isn't, Christian. That's one thing about it. It doesn't matter what you pay for your management in the NHL, so good on the Leafs for getting the wallets out, I think. And the Rads tweets in about the Blue Jays. He is not impressed with AA at all. It's not a surprise. AA is useless in season. The Rads, thank you. Thanks for all your tweets. At the Raj 590, anything we're talking about, those are issues we did talk about. Let's talk about the RBC Canadian Open as well, boys. It's not the event of all events that it was years ago, Gare, and you'll certainly remember back in the day when the Canadian Open was really considered the fifth major. People don't believe me when I say that, but it was. Trust us.
When it fell between the U.S. Open and the British Open.
Correct. On the schedule, on the calendar, and the top players came here, and it was considered it's a national tournament, but it is what it is, and the scores have been pretty good at the Abbey. The guys are shooting the lights out so far.
Yes. I have to say, I when the British Open was extended into Monday play when they had the weather on Saturday. I thought that the field would take a bit of a hit, and you know that a Jason Day comes out and plays in this after a heartbreak, and I mean he was out there all 5 days at St. Andrews. You know, I mean I think we look at PGA players and think that, you know, they live inside the bubble, they're entitled or pampered or whatever, that these guys flew over, you know, and kept their commitment. I think that's pretty admirable. And, you know, it's a decent field, you know, after a British Open, you're always going to take a bit of a hit. It's probably the worst timing that you could have for a tournament, you know, on the calendar. But, you know, it's, and it's in against the Pan Ams, but it's still pretty watchable stuff.
Been great so far. Chad Campbell, 63 in round two, a two-round total of 130, 14 under at the top of the leaderboard. Brian Harman, David Hearn, a Canadian. Ben, how important, at least, I don't know, important, but how much about time and how much fun would it be a Canadian to do it, especially after Graham Dillette has to pull out with an injury after the first round?
Yeah, it's too bad that Dillette's not in this one, but it is always nice when you see those Canadians making a run. I think you just want one compelling story, one reason to watch. You know, with the British Open, it was Spieth, for me at least, as a fan, just watching him. Can he do it? Can he hold on and come back? It seemed as though that was the storyline to follow. I think as long as you have one angle, if you're anything less than a hardcore fan, it is nice to have that one thing to latch onto.
Hearn is in third and hanging around the top of the leaderboard, Garen. Why is it that the Canadians never won the event? I mean, Mike Weir has been a dominant golfer in his day. We've had good golfers. A lot of it has to do with the fact that it's a tough tournament to win, but boy, this drought is decades now.
Well, George Knutson should have won. George Knutson.
Between puffs of the cigarette, maybe?
Yeah. No, it's funny. And I used to go to school with George Knutson's
son. Oh, really?
Yeah. Met him on Parents Night. Great guy. But he was a tremendous golfer. I know that people will always talk about, geez, you know, Mike Weir wins a Masters and career money and things like that. I don't think that he was half the striker of a ball that George Knutson was. Not much of a putter, but you know, you would think that we would produce a golfer, and you know, that would be, and I mean, Weir was close.
Had a three-shot lead after three rounds, I believe.
Yeah, that one that got away. Yeah. But you know what? Like, we've had Canadians win on the tour. We've had, you know, but. It's a lot to ask that they're going to win this one particular tournament. It just it hasn't fallen that way.
David Hearn sits three shots back at 11 under, tied for third with Johnson Wagner, and round three getting underway shortly at the Abbey today. Hopefully the weather holds out, and hi to everybody who's visiting the city for the Canadian Open, RBC Canadian Open as well. Lots of things in town. Pan Am Games wrapping up and the Canadian Open as well. I didn't even want to spend a lot of time, and we won't spend a lot of time talking about what Colin Cowherd said, because it's just redundant to suggest anything beyond the fact that how ignorant and what a stupid thing to say. But maybe, guys, I can get both your reads, especially because you're from different generations, in how it should be handled when somebody like that makes a statement like that. And, well, let's face it, Colin Cowherd, everybody thinks, is going to Fox, and he's not going to miss a beat. He was leaving ESPN anyway. Ben, you're a younger guy. What do you think of this?
Well, I just think it's such a shame that someone in really a position of influence would go out and suggest that Dominican ball players, and by extension Dominican people, are somehow unintelligent. You know, it's completely false and misleading, and it's a real shame that he would say that. And I think that, you know, you see so many smart players, Jose Bautista being the most prominent in this city, a very smart person. And I think that just to suggest that Dominicans are somehow unable to comprehend the game of baseball is ridiculous.
I thought that Pedro Martinez had the greatest comeback. It was, I'm sorry, he needs to get up to my level to answer him. I'm in the Hall of Fame. I would rather listen to Pedro Martinez do talk radio than Colin Cowherd. I have to say, I worked at ESPN for 8 years. You know, I've been out at Bristol, and I worked for the magazine that time. And what Colin Cowherd was doing at ESPN, I have not the foggiest idea. He was always such a poor fit as far as I was concerned. And, you know, for a message like this to come out of, you know, the worldwide leader, which is one of the most progressive workplaces that I've ever been in, you know, and this no knock at Rogers. We're progressive, but pointedly, ESPN is like a bellwether in terms of fairness and appropriate speech and all of that. And you know, I almost feel like it was a calculated thing with Cowherd. You know, it's hard to imagine anyone saying something like that, actually planning to say something like that. But you know, with him going to Fox, this type of stuff passes for, you know, sharp commentary on Fox. You know, it's a good place for him to land, you know, and easy for him to be ignored there.
You know, and that's the saddest part of the entire thing, is it probably increases his profile on Fox instead of decrease it. Some people think, oh, maybe now they won't hire him. Now they'll probably be even more anxious to hire him. I think it's troubling. I think it's unfortunate. I'm not embarrassed to say I barely knew who the guy was, because I don't listen to guys like that. That's not my cup of tea. And I think a lot of people who get a following of a person like that, who just says, and never, this particular comment is beyond defensible. It was ridiculous, and he mishandled the apology, and it's an idiot to say that on air. So I think we're all in agreement on that. But I just look at that kind of culture that breeds, those people are successful. And they're successful because it's like the old back in the day of the shock jocks, is the people that love you listen for an hour, and the people that hate you listen for 2 hours. And that's the key to those guys' success, which is, yeah, I don't know what he's doing, but clearly this guy has a following. Clearly he's had a career at ESPN, and clearly they saw some value in that kind of shtick being on air to start with. I think, and for ESPN, it's bloody discouraging, if you ask me.
Yeah, I mean, he has always been a bit of a flamethrower, you know. Now, it's another level entirely with something like that. And I'm fully expecting more of the same rather than a step back going to Fox. It was sort of a weird week for ESPN with Bill Simmons landing at HBO and then this going down.
Good for Bautista for calling him out, too. Oh, I like that part of it, too.
Yeah, it was fantastic.
It is. He did well to do that. And I think that there's just such a difference between someone who goes on the radio and talks about a subject and an interest. I mean, we've disagreed on this show earlier today. And I think that there's a difference between that and someone who's outright racist or sexist. It's just that you're crossing a line at that point.
Who wins a chess game? Between Bautista and Colin Cowherd, you know,
that might be fun. We'll see who's smart and who's not, that's for sure. Sportsnet Magazine Live, I'm Roger Lajoie for Ben S. Gara Joyce, Ben Nicholson-Smith with me here in studio. So the National Hockey League finally admits, although we all knew it, they were looking at an expansion, but now they admit, we started the process, guys. Here's what we're going to do. And their process, very simply, was $10 million, $2 million non-refundable, ducks in order, an arena, make sure you've got everything done to even be considered for expansion. Las Vegas, in. Quebec City, in. Toronto, Seattle, not in. Is it a case of no arena does not work, although Seattle could have the facility? I mean, Gare, two, and I guess it just shows my economic status. $2 million, non-refundable, just to sit down and talk with Gary Bettman and Bill Daly.
It takes a lot of gall. You know, I was going to say it takes stones, but it takes gall, really, to have that as, a bar to clear on opening. I have to say, I was thoroughly unsurprised by the fact that Seattle did not get a bid together. You know what? I know that so many people talk about the potential of Seattle as a hockey market, and Gary Bettman, it's like one of his dreams, but there is zero grassroots support in Seattle for it. Venue, there's just like no shot. Any stadium that's on the table right now is really basketball dedicated in its planning. I mean, you go to a junior hockey game in Seattle, and you know, it's the home of the $2 ticket and $2 beer. You know, like, I mean, they have trouble getting 4,000 fans or 3,000 fans out at those prices. You know, where's you know, the attraction for an NHL price? Yeah, so I wasn't surprised by that. In Toronto, I've always thought the next stadium, this alternative stadium, was a complete pipe dream. I've never given it any weight at all. So, you know, Quebec's there. And against all reason, Vegas is there.
What do you think, Ben?
Well, it's definitely an expensive meeting if you're talking $2 million. And as for which locations, I mean, it seems as though the fact that the NHL is entertaining this suggests that, you know, that they're going down that path. And there's always that temptation, those expansion fees. If it's $2 million for a meeting, how many millions is it for a franchise? And at that point, you're lining the coffers of anyone else who's already in the club.
How do you cater that? You know, coming in $2 million. Like, seriously, it better
have some donuts or something there. Here's the thing: if the fee, and people say, why don't they just move Phoenix to Las Vegas, and why don't they just move Florida to Quebec City, and everybody will work out? Here's why, and we put the numbers down. If the expansion fee, which is brandied about at $500 million, which is ridiculous, but $500 million, that's $1 billion. 30 teams in the NHL. So you're at the NHL Board of Governors meetings. Boys, here's what we're going to do. We're going to bring in two more teams, and every team is going to get $33 million. How do you feel about that? And nobody says, I guarantee you, nobody says, well, you know what? It might dilute the product a little bit, or I don't know if Vegas is that. If some idiot in Las Vegas wants to put a hockey team in Las Vegas and has the money and has an arena, go ahead. It's the same thing, and Gary, I know it's near and dear to you too. It's the same thing people talk about baseball in Montreal. You want to talk about a pipe dream? Baseball in Montreal is only lacking two things: a stadium and an owner. And that's the only thing that matters. Stadium and owner and everything else. You got a Twitter account and a couple former Expos dusting off some things. That's all fine and dandy. The NHL takes a look and they go, you're right, Las Vegas is beyond stupid hockey team, whatever. The guy's a billionaire. He's got an arena. He wants to do it. NHL owners, $33 million in your pocket. All in favor? I'm in.
Yeah, for the commish, I think that it's how he envisions a fanfare on his exit. You know, as the big act in the last reel of his long stint as commissioner, to be able to say to owners, you know, here's a little parting gift. You know, here's
$33 million, yeah. And we got a team in Vegas now.
Yeah, that this is, I mean, if he's writing the story of his time and he's had a bunch of big wins, not the least of them getting a salary cap in or payroll cap in and digging a grave for Bob Goodenough in the process, you know, this would be like his last great act.
Ben, yep. What do you think about Quebec City?
Well, it would be a lot of fun. I mean, as a fan, to see another team back in Quebec City would be really tremendous. And it does sound as though, you know, that rivalry, Canadiens and the Nordiques, would be just tremendous to see. But there are all those logistical hurdles to get through in the meantime.
Should we not be concerned about the Canadian dollar again, Gare? Just like history revisiting itself, dropping to 77 cents. Now, Winnipeg's ownership is beyond wealthy, but you know, the Ottawa Senators, Quebec City, even to a certain extent, Calgary, you know, other Canadian markets. I mean, and the salary cap going up and up. Don't we run the risk again of history repeating itself?
Well, absolutely. I mean, we're a resource economy. The Canadian, it isn't the Canadian dollar, it's the Canadian petrodollar, right? Like, we're gonna ride the roller coaster with oil prices. It is getting to that point, exchange rate, where we were talking about teams leaving Canada, you know, rather than teams in Canada being the most profitable in the NHL. You know, you just go back to the late 90s, you know, Ottawa was heading out of town. God, even at some point, you know, like, it looked like the Canadians were in trouble. You know, that was when the dollar was sort of in the high 60s, like it down as far as 66, probably.
63, I recall.
Yeah.
Being the lowest. And now it's at 77 and dropping. Who knows how much further? Like, I don't know.
Yeah.
I just, you talk about, there's a reason there isn't a team in Quebec City to start with. And there's a reason Winnipeg left as well. And they may have wealthy ownership, Ben, but boy, I'll tell you what, it makes me nervous when I see these numbers.
Absolutely. It's a real bottom line thing. And I think that, you know, when you talk about franchise expansion, relocation, really so much of it comes down to money. And if the Canadian dollar is flagging a little bit, then that's going to be a huge factor in how this all unfolds.
Well, guys, if we want to do the show again together, it's going to cost you guys $2 million, non-refundable. So anyway, hopefully we'll see you next
time. Get it catered, for sure.
Yeah, bring some good coffee, and we'll be here.
Garrett Joyce, Ben Nicholson-Smith, real treat to be with you guys. Your work in Sportsnet magazine is terrific, and great to be in to Ben, especially with you guys here. Thanks so much.
Thanks,
you.
That's Ben Nicholson-Smith, Garrett Joyce. I'm Roger Lajoie for Ben Ennis. Thanks to Emil Delich, our technical director. Mike Sesney, our producer. Coming up, Sportsnet today. Sean McKenzie at the Canadian Open. Drew Eubanks on the great basketball game last night. Brad Gagne on the NFL. And Mike Wilner on those Blue Jays. All still to come right here on Sportsnet 590, The Fan.